Replacing some anxiety with information about the cost and the quality. Well, the quality stuff I just described for you. The data is now being generated. So we don't have to just fall to the level of ask your friend's, you know, neighbor's beautician what she knows because she goes and does people's hair there, okay? It's a little more sophisticated now that we actually have some objective information about what facilities are quote-unquote good and not, and we're not wholly dependent as we were at one time on the admissions staff of that very facility to tell us how good they are. We actually have the ability to be able to cross-check some things. But likewise, in terms of cost, increasingly that cost data is coming out. Now, it is an incredibly skewed economy, okay? Private pay, remember, when you have that many people who are being paid for by a third party, that changes third-party payment. Any of you have studied economics, third-party payment always creates a skew, moral hazard, as it's sometimes referred. If somebody can get more services of something and not having to pay more, they have the tendency to get more of those services. But bottom line is that we end up having private pay residents probably paying, in many cases, more than the cost of their care because they're making up for the fact that the rest of the community is there. It is what it is, but you'll notice that the pricing can vary very widely. By and large, because of the Medicaid presence, the third-party payer in nursing homes, the pricing of nursing homes tends to be driven on the basis of that phenomenon. Assisted living can be all over the place. The very definition of what we refer to as an assisted living, a residential care facility, can range from basically we provide 3 squares and we'll check in on you from time to time if you want us to, and that's about the level of care, all the way to residential care facilities that are doing the exact same functions that even 5 years ago would have taken place at a nursing home. There are residential care facilities in Northeast Ohio that can provide care to people all the way to the level of hospice. So the law gives a great deal of latitude in that regard, depending upon what it is that is needed. And obviously, folks like the Erie Agency on Aging have a deep, deep commitment to trying to make sure that folks end up in the most residential, least restrictive level of care that will take care of their needs. That the idea would be that we're not putting people into a more constrained medical environment unless they have a need for that kind of constrained medical environment, if at all possible. Eligibility for public benefits is the other place, and we'll talk a little bit about at least two of the biggies in that regard in this section, which is the Veterans Administration, some of you had questions about, and the Medicaid program, okay? But knowing those kinds of pieces of information of for what I am eligible. If you go, exercise, in discovering benefits that you might be available, there is a function within the aging community called that you can reach on the internet called a benefits checkup. Any of you ever done it? Did a benefits checkup? Gail, that's not fair. The benefits checkup is a actually interactive program. On the internet, you can get through the area agencies on aging. You can get there through a number of different public entities. Benefits checkup is basically they ask you a series of questions. Picture any of you have ever done your taxes using like TurboTax or Tax Cut or something like that, right? So they ask you a series of questions, and depending upon how you answer those questions, it leads you to another set of questions. And ultimately, by the time all is over, it reports back that what, based on your income, needs, and community, what services might be available, public setting services that might be available. Now, once you kind of fine-tune that down, the really most complicated programs would be probably the two that we're going to talk about a little bit more this morning, which would be the VA program and its eligibility for benefits, and the Medicaid program and its eligibility for benefits. Second step. After replacing anxiety with information, is to de-stress the decision making. Okay, the single most important element of de-stressing that environment is to make sure we know who's making decisions for whom. Okay, I won't ask for a show of hands, but I'm gonna guess that the vast majority of this room has a will written. But I'm gonna guess, based on my experience, that far fewer of you have named someone as your attorney in fact in powers of attorney. Well, let's walk that through. The will is quite relevant as long as you're dead. You just heard my theology. I am far less worried about you if you're dead. I'm far more concerned about that period of time leading up to death for lots of different reasons. Stuff is still ultimately stuff. So we go to a lot of trouble, and we've learned, and our legal colleagues have encouraged us to learn, to make sure that you've given some direction to people about what happens to your stuff after you're gone. But far fewer of us have given direction to anybody about taking care of me when I'm still around, but I'm not able to make decisions for myself. In some cases, we find that actually we've written documents along with that attorney, attached them on in, that said, well, make sure this doesn't happen to me, make sure this doesn't happen to me, but I actually haven't named another person to implement any of that, to make decisions on my behalf. That's a power of attorney. Power of attorney, and again, as I shared with you before, I'm not an attorney. I'm not a producer of these documents. I'm a consumer of these documents. I spend my week reading people's powers of attorney and their trusts and their wills and kind of sorting through this kind of stuff from a financial planning perspective. And my greatest concern with regard to elder care is, number one, have I named a proxy for the right kinds of decisions? And is that person actually behaving right now as my proxy? Meaning, have I been building a relationship with that person so that when it comes time that I might be incapacitated, they actually know me. They know my values, they know my purposes, they know what I want, what I don't want. That demands communication. So just getting their name down someplace is the first step. It's not the last step, but it is the first step. I don't know why it is, but it's sort of the same thing with babies getting born. Crisis medical events always seem to occur at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I don't care how they change the rules on it. Medical residents are tired at that time of the day. It just is what it is. And nothing is more frustrating on the receiving end at an emergency room than to not have clarity about who has the right to make decisions right now. Or to be in a situation where you have a family member, but you have reason to believe that there might be another family member or another party who actually has the ability to supersede the opinion of this family member. I'd like to tell you that in our current medical community, the bad part of that story is that they'll wait on everything and they won't do anything. We are far too litigious, too high liability of community for that actually to be the case. They are more likely to do something. They are more likely to move forward. If that, in fact, is moving forward in an action that mom or dad did not want to have happen, now the next recourse is, okay, so remove the intubation. Take the life support off now, thank you. Any of you that have walked through that journey know exactly what I'm talking about, of how difficult that is. I'm not talking physiologically difficult. Talking about something that could have been prevented by having a clear channel and a clear path to whose communication, who was given the authority to be able to do this as per the proxy authorities, and is their number to be able to reach them there? Do I have access to that person? Please.
Did you just switch from financial power of attorney to healthcare power of attorney?
No, but you just teed me up like a little t-ball game for a bunch of kids. Thank you. There are two documents. There are two documents. Okay? There are the ability, or two sets of documents, if you will. The one has to do with healthcare powers. In other words, to whom do I direct the medical decision making? It doesn't have to be the same proxy, but that you name for both. For some of your families, it might be one person. For some of it might be the same person. It might be two different people. Recognizing the fact that there could be some conflict there. If you have one person that has been empowered to work with the physicians about making the decisions, and another person empowered to decide whether to pay for those decisions, you could have a wonderful check and balance, or you could have a nasty quid pro quo. And you'll have to sort that through. But the first is a durable power of attorney for healthcare. It's actually so standardized in our state that you can go online and find the approved form that the medical associations, the hospice organizations, and the like all have agreed to. It's only got a couple of decisions embedded into it. Yes, do I have the authority to be able to deny food and fluids to this person or not? That's a specific recommendation. And if not me, then whom? And I can't tell you how terribly important that is. That secondary or contingent proxy is terribly important. Because if I give to my spouse, for instance, if I give to my spouse the authority to be able to make decisions, that seems very reasonable. My spouse is a really, really good nurse. mean, she's the real nurse of the family. And she'd be exactly the person that I would trust. But I could also see instances, and I want my kids to understand, I could see instances where what has happened to me and what is ahead of me and the decisions that need to be made about particularly letting me leave and go be with Jesus are such that Siobhan wouldn't necessarily want to be the person to make that decision. And at least in that context, she might need to be the person who needs to recuse herself from that and have one of the kids step in, or somebody else that I've named, my attorney, to step in and make that decision as I would have wanted it. So, durable power of attorney for healthcare. Along with that, sometimes it's embedded in, not in the standard form, is a thing called a HIPAA release. HIPAA, as you may recall, were the set of regulations around both privacy and portability of healthcare coverages. The key here is making sure that whomever, certainly the proxy that's making decisions for you, but anybody else that you wish to be informed has the legal authority to be informed. That it wouldn't be an invasion of your privacy for a physician or a nurse to share that information with that person. They have to have a HIPAA release to do that. So durable power of attorney for healthcare. For the vast majority of us, that document shouldn't cost you anything. Most of the solid elder lawyers that I know will make sure you have one of those, and if they charge you anything at all, it's a nothing. It's an administrative level fee to be able to do that. Because everybody should have one of those, and the language is not particularly specialized. That's very different from the general durable power of attorney that has to do with my banking, some of my legal affairs, my financial affairs. That one could be extremely specific to your situation. And might be very crucial to make sure that that person has been empowered to be able to work with somebody like me. Or for that matter, to be able to even go to the bank. We're increasingly getting in a position where in the absence of those clear kinds of instruments, and let's be honest, the conversation that has to go along with creating those instruments, talking to your kid and sharing with them, this is what I want, this is what I don't want, sometimes to avoid those, we end up in a situation saying, well, I'll just put your name in the bank account. And then you manage everything. And for those of us in the financial service industry, we know we can create massive amounts of complexity, problems, in terms of who owns what. What that means in terms of eligibility for public benefits, how those funds are controlled, under what titling do they exist, that really in that particular case could have been avoided simply by making sure that there was a proxy in place. So healthcare powers of attorney, durable general power of attorney for banking and those types of instruments. There are other legal instruments. Bear with me for just a second. There are other legal instruments that may be appropriate. Some of you may be or could be under certain circumstances in a position where you want to have more control over how your assets, your resources are distributed than is able to be presented to you. Incidentally, regularly, on a weekly basis, I bump into folks that say, I got my will, I went to this seminar and I got this nice leather-bound trust. It actually doesn't have any assets inside of it. But this is what I own. And I see a couple of IRAs, which incidentally have named beneficiaries, a few bank accounts that may be in any number of different titlings, but certainly could be transferred upon death. And insurance instruments, maybe life insurance policy and an annuity, something like that. Again, named beneficiaries. I'm looking at it kind of not wanting to mention that I hope you didn't pay too much for that beautiful leather bound, because that leather bound and what's it up to now, $1.50, will get you a rapid ride downtown. You know, it's not worth a whole lot to you because there's nothing that needs to go into it necessarily. Conversely, there's other people who, my situation is much more complicated. If I just simply gave those dollars to that person, that person who, in fact, might be my progeny, I give those dollars to that person, I could be cursing them more than blessing them. They don't know how to manage it. They don't know what to do with it. There is no way in their current. That would be just pouring fuel onto that flame of foolishness, and I'd be hurting that person and everybody that comes after. For those kinds of folks, having an entity like a trust where you can attach a set of rules may be the perfect planning in that regard. But the key here is having an actual, first things first, a proxy, a person in place with whom you have established legal documents that give them the authority, but that's the beginning of a sustaining relationship. How does that sustaining relationship work? Well, let's talk about the healthcare power of attorney, for example. Mrs. Jones up the street has a stroke. Mrs. Jones up the street having a stroke is a moment for a conversation. And I'm not sure why we lost. Okay, I was not one of those AV club guys, but we'll have to figure this one out. That's okay. Is it resting?
Yeah, it might have just timed out.
Enough? Okay, sorry. For those on the recording, I apologize. Okay. Thanks, Jackie. Let me give an example, real quick example. Mrs. Jones up the street has her stroke. That is the window of opportunity, for instance, for me as my parents' attorney in fact to initiate a conversation about, so how do you think she's doing? So do you know anything, what her kids are going to be doing at this point? What's going to be happening if she gets out of the hospital? Do you know what kind of care needs she might have? We're talking about Mrs. Jones, right? Not really. We're bringing out, so Mom, how would you want that differently than Mrs. Jones? What would you want me to do? It's one continued conversation after another. It is the beginning of a relationship because I recognize the fact that my job as a proxy is not just hold my breath and hope I never have to actually use that document. My job as a proxy is to be increasingly one who will defend the values, the motives, the intents of another human being. I better be prepared to do that. Hopefully a job I'll never have to do, but let's be honest. There's lots of functions in our society. Ask any honorable Christian soldier about jobs that you train for and prepare for with the prayer that you'll never actually have to use those skills and the time never comes. But nevertheless, you prepare because when they come, they're going to be needed. And that's the nature of the proxy. Now, those in non-attorney's language, those instruments are different in one very, very material way. The first is the healthcare power of attorney. It doesn't actually spring into any kind of authority unless there's incapacity. It specifically states that, you know, I mean, if I'm on the gurney and they're bringing me through, and Siobhan's saying, don't pay attention to him, he doesn't know what he's talking about, let me tell you what you should do for him, okay? I'm well within my rights to say, tell her to be quiet, this is what I want. We don't actually talk, well, maybe we do occasionally talk to each other, but in any case, you get the idea. It only is in effect if I am incapacitated. If I'm either unconscious or cognitively impaired, so on and so forth. At that point, then my proxy needs to step in for me. That's not true of the durable general power of attorney. And so that's why it's very important that we consider about how broad the powers are that you give this person or how defined they are. And good attorneys know how to work with guys like me to be able to parse that out with our client to make sure that we're doing this appropriately, that we're giving latitude to deal with good planning, which we need broad latitude for, but that we're also not giving authority to people because those powers are immediate. You get that document and it says you are the durable general power of attorney. You can go to the bank that afternoon and be mom. Be dad. Do whatever you wish to do using those authorities as long as those authorities have been recognized by that institution that you have a valid document. That's a big deal. It's a big distinction between the two. Now, they can be written with springing within capacity, but that's highly limiting for most of the kinds of things that we're doing. So for the most part, most durable general power of attorneys have immediate effect. And it's important to consider that. But your family context will make all the difference in the world. And or your non-family context. You know, for many, I'm now at a wonderful transition point, if you will, in my estate planning with my family, in the early days when the kids were little, we had appointed a non-family member, brother and sister in Christ, another family actually here at this church that was with us at the time, to, if need be, serve as the guardian for my children and steward those resources of whatever we had at that time in terms of insurance and the like to make sure that the children were raised. I am deeply blessed that I have two kids that know the Lord and are walking pretty solidly with them, and I am at this wonderful transition point where I no longer need that other family And I can work with my attorney now to be able to possibly have those resources stewarded by that next generation. And I got some training to do in the process. Our teeny tiny little giving fund that we've created, at least by our standards, is a ministry fund in part to be able to teach the kids how to give. And that over the next years, that's one of our challenges, right? Is to raise up the child in the way he should go. One of those is, what is good ministry? What is worth investing in, and how do you do that, and how do you be a good steward over those kinds of things in order to be able to get to that next place? So all of this demands work by both generations to make sure that it works through, but it's important to recognize that one of the instruments is powerful immediately. One of the instruments has a springing authority attached to it, and they can be modified depending upon your family situation, depending upon where you are. I wanted to make at least some mention about the end-of-life kinds of considerations in all of this. A proxy is a person. A proxy is a human being who hopefully knows your values. They are your attorney in fact, is what the agent of a durable power of attorney is, the attorney in fact. That person then speaks on your behalf. But there are other written documents that you could create. And I'm going to, again, I'm just going to give you broadly, I encourage you to be hesitant. Just be careful about the use of those documents. Okay? In other words, having a person who knows your values, that person, and is good, has good judgment, that person can deal with whatever the circumstances are that are ahead of them. The clinical conditions that you're dealing with, the technological availability at the time to be able to help us make good decisions, and so on and so forth. All those contextual kinds of things. Things that if you write some kind of an advance directive, if you write a living will, for instance, it may be a long period of time between when you wrote that document and what's happening now. Technology may have changed during that period of time. Our clinical understandings may have changed during that time. The legal environment may have changed during that period of time. But to some degree now, you have a document that this person now at least has to attend to some degree. You've set some parameters. Be careful about doing that. In the end, if they're clear enough, that document could supersede the proxy. So the proxy could be saying one thing, and there's a smoking gun document that, for instance, another family member could come in and say, no, Dad said this. Mom said this. And all those conversations that may have modified that document, all of a sudden will now have to deal with a directive that, let's be honest, my colleagues in medicine will have to deal with the liability of either regarding or disregarding some of those documents in terms of what they do or they don't do. So it's very, very important occasionally for a period of time, it seems to be abating now, but for a period of time, we had a window where it was increasingly common that people were having some kind of an advance directive written, a living will. And they were parking it away like it was an estate planning document that will get pulled out upon the right moment. And they weren't even talking to their kids about it. In fact, there was sort of this sense of privacy. It's fine. I took care of everything. Don't worry, kids. I got it all covered. Expecting that then they can walk in and that somehow, with no other relationship involved, they would be able to implement any of your wishes. That's actually a testimony to just bad family communication. And the first place we need to start is that family communication before anything else. Incidentally, last piece I wanted to mention had to do with funeral planning. And this purely is just an issue. There are times where in eligibility for public benefits, it also makes sense to get prepaid funerals. But honestly, I'm going to highly commend you. At some level, a pre-planning for a funeral is relevant for all of us. I know I've shared this story previously on this side because I've heard it on recordings earlier. And it's poignantly morbid depending upon who you are. But I happen to think it's kind of sweet that if I go to the lockbox at home, I know the yellow folder. I pop it open, and no matter what else, you know, birth certificates and stuff like that might be in there, okay? When I pop open the lockbox, one of the things is going to be this yellow folder. That's about as far as Richard and Siobhan have gotten in funeral planning. But if you open it up, you're going to see Siobhan's list of scripture readings and the hymns. My wife, unlike her husband, is a very private person, deeply, deeply felt. She's going to make sure, and if any of you are there, she's going to make sure that there's one last shot that she's got to loudly proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ and to make sure that you're at least going to be given the opportunity to sing it. And that's the beginnings of our planning. Now, let's be honest. The deeper I go in my planning on this, the more burden I'm taking off of my kids. I'm actually doing some things that will allow them in that space to do what they're supposed to be doing. Grieve a little, if that's appropriate. Celebrate, as it would be appropriate. Whatever it is that they're supposed to be doing. But I can assure you, and any of you who are morticians, I apologize for taking business from you right now, but it's not a really good time to be making business decisions. And we're talking about substantial amounts of money here. $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 of transactions, things you would not normally do without a lot of deliberation, are having to be made within a short period of time under a period of lots of duress, lots of emotion, and incoming family. Why? Why? It can be avoided in many cases by having some of that planning done now. Family issues, you'll see the next slide hopefully there. Next step in de-stressing the decision making. Next step in de-stressing decision making has to do with how we appoint and what roles siblings, children are going to have in the midst of all of this. And you know, as I mentioned to you before, the key element in elder care planning is to try to be a good representative of the parents' values. The danger with that is you've got a whole number of people that are interacting around it. And I would venture to guess, if there's any single place where we have diversity and, oi, could you tell me some stories, it has to do with you and your family members and adult sibling groups. The only piece that I want to remind you of, and is importance particularly for those of you who are the more senior saints in the room, to be aware of, is how deeply entrenched our family background ends up affecting our behavior. It blows me away. I've seen this so many times. I could literally be at the table and I find out the background of the multiple siblings around the table, adult children. And Tim is the CEO of a major corporation. He's got people that all day long are asking him, you know, Tim, what do you want to do about this? Or how are we going to lead this? He's leading this major enterprise, okay? But when he's at that table, he's Timmy. He's 15 years old. He interacts with his siblings exactly the same way as he would have back whenever they sort of froze framed the family dinner table. And the behaviors, and he may, intentionally, he doesn't jump up and assert, wait a second, I know what I'm doing here. Are you kidding me? Anybody at this table that's got leadership gifts, it's me. Mm-mm. He's Timmy. Everybody falls into their different positions. Particularly sometimes, sadly, sometimes female voices that should be the loudest in light of everything I told you about care sometimes become the most diminutive. Family members who live with the greatest distance away all of a sudden become the prophets outside of your own hometown, and they feel like all of a sudden their voice becomes really, really relevant, and then they're going to get back on the airplane. So it's very, very important for us to remember that, and this isn't with conflict necessarily. This is people acquiescing back into the roles of how this family was supposed to be at one point or another. Freeze framing on whatever was the last dysfunction when they were all back together again. And usually those dysfunctions start with the silence that exists. I mean, I'm blessed that I have a number of colleagues who asked me to do radio programs. And a couple of them are really sharp because they'll ask me to do their call-in radio programs and stuff in that space just before Thanksgiving or between Thanksgiving and Christmas. No, because it's when does family see each other? And you're going to have those little sidebar conversations. You think something going on with mom? Oh, no, be quiet. I forget stuff too. I mean, come on. No, really, I mean, you do think she's okay. I mean, well, I don't know. We'll talk about it next year. But that's windows of time when the family gets together around holidays and have those odd little sidebar communications. Incidentally, for those of you who are of my middle-aged generation, your parents are having the exact same conversations with each other. Should we tell the kids? No, we shouldn't burden them. They're so busy, the college stuff, and the kids are... No. So everybody's having these little sidebar conversations with each other. They're not necessarily having it. And there's these moments in time where everybody's back in their cars, everybody's back in the airplane, they're leaving after Christmas, and they've got this big, hanging, unsaid conversation that's going to float around, likely by email, for the next number of months thereafter, about mom and dad. rather than actually stopping and as I described it before, and let's see if we can get to the correct slide here. Bear with me, I'm somewhere in here. Sorry guys, bear with me. What I ultimately end up hoping toward is what I refer to as a family meeting. Now that family meeting can be at different points in process. It is common for me in my practice to make sure that if I have senior clients, elder clients, that I am working with them around designing. Yes, is there a little bit of theater involved in that? Of course there's a little bit of theater. I'll tell you a quick story to see if it'll help. But the idea is try to get the parties together, establish who has a voice here, who does not have a voice here, okay? Get everybody's input in, but make it very, very clear that my client is always the elder adult, period. Recognizing people's conflicts of interest along the way and making sure that whatever mom and dad or mom or dad decided should be the roles of those family members, those are the roles that we're going to adhere to and those are the roles we're going to hold, okay, and all of it. Because of absence of time, let me be clear about, and I apologize, if somebody needs to take a break, go ahead. I'm going to just keep kind of pushing through here with the technical difficulties. The family meeting, let me just give an example. All right, and between you and me and anybody who listens on this tape on the website or this recording on the website will know what I'm talking about. I have a little trick that I occasionally use, if this helps. You can imagine whenever I have a family meeting, I tend to have my senior clients sitting either on either side of me or if there's only one of them off to the side of me. And first thing is I'll keep the family waiting out in the waiting room for a little bit. Even if we're just chit-chatting, I just want to reestablish the situation here. Because inevitably, there's somebody out there in the waiting room who thinks I should have been meeting with them first, you know, and getting the lowdown and the dope on what really is going on here. And so we kind of rebalance that a little bit, make sure that we're showing some honor where honor is due, okay? But then I will have inform my client that as I sit here next to you and we're going on with this meeting, my foot is going to be out in front of your foot. Treat it like a brake pedal. If at any point during the meeting this is not going where you want it to go, just give me a little tap. I'll try to redirect the conversation. Give me another tap if you need to, and I will cut this. We'll sidebar. We'll find out what's the matter, and we'll move forward in the meeting. Simple principle. Particularly large, involved family. We lots of voices going back and forth. Sweet little lady sitting next to me, and the one sister who I discovered out of some context that I'd picked up ahead of time was maybe the family ne'er-do-well, maybe a little bit more dependent upon parents over a longer period of time, and so on and so forth. You get the picture, okay? Everybody's got one in their family, and if you don't, it's probably you. but in any case. This person, okay, so I'm getting to the point in the conversation. We were actually talking some Medicaid planning at this point. And I expressed to them that one of the elements of Medicaid planning is that there is certain privileges that come to in-home caregivers, okay? There's certain opportunities that arise. So, for instance, with this particular mom who needed supervision all the time, if a family member came in, we had medical attestation that, in fact, for at least a 24-month period of time, that person being able to stay in home was dependent upon that child living there, then that home could be quit claimed over to that child. And it would not be considered an ineligible transfer for Medicaid. It was a preserved asset. So it could be the largest single thing they own in their entire financial portfolio could be passed down with impunity. They could start getting public benefits to that caregiving child. Kind of a big deal, eh? Right? I mean, it's a wonderful piece of the administrative code that very few people know about, but in this case, I thought maybe it's going to be relative. So you can imagine that daughter nearly jumps up out of her seat. Oh, Mom, we would have the best time together. We'd be so much fun. I'll take you places and we'll do things and it would be so nice to do. I thought the little old lady was going to break my foot. The importance to keep the primacy of the aging parent in the midst of this, even if, in fact, the proxy is ultimately going to have to be the one that makes the decisions moving forward. A family meeting, trying to generate that communication, is literally the single most important part of moving things forward. Next step in de-stressing, or next step along our planning process, is to simplify the finances. I won't overburden this, okay? Because each of you are in different places. Some of you have a lot of resources to be responsible for. Some of you have very little. But everybody should have, okay? If you're a steward, right, you're working for somebody else. You work for somebody else, you got to give an accounting. And trust me, if you don't give it now as a regular part of your life, you are at one point in time. I assure you of this, and I could show you chapter and verse to that end. But everybody needs to keep an accounting, right? I've had to with folks that are in supervisory positions over me, and I've expected it of people that I was supervising, right? That there would be some kind of an accounting for your time, for the resources, for the outcomes, and so on and so forth. It's a budget. That's all. It's this nasty, dirty word that we hate using. No, I don't have a budget. Budget does many, many things other than constrain you and control you, though in many cases, one of its greatest blessings, it can constrain you and control you. But for starters, it can describe what's going on. It can explain what's going on. It can predict what might go on under certain circumstances. So a budget, and I know some of you well enough to know that this is an area that you have created disciplines over time to make sure I kind of know what's coming in, I know what's going out, I have a rough idea of what's being put away for the future. I'm good to be able to, at very least, describe what's going on, explain, and predict it. So if something all of a sudden is jumping out, I know exactly, you know, that credit card that gets paid off every month, automatically deducted, I know very well that number shouldn't be greater than that particular number. What's inside of there, honestly, I don't really pay a whole lot of attention to, you know? But if it pops over that number, it gets my attention now. That's level of budgeting, right? For a guy with all of this training and all this stuff, at my household, that's about where I am right now, and that works. It's not onerous. It's a blessing. It keeps things guiding on in the same way the idiot lights on my car will tell me, Richard, you're about to burn out your engine. It would be really wise for you to do something about this now. Sort of the same way. Those kinds of tools become that much more important because your mind is not supposed to be on the money. Your mind, the money is the resource, remember? It's the means, not the end. And so the idea would be to try to simplify this as much as possible. There are certain patterns to different diagnoses. Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, frail diabetics, that we're discovering there's certain patterns to the type of expenses that are common for those folks. And it's important to know those. But in the end, it's going to have to be specific to this particular person, and we'll know that over time by looking at that budget and sorting it through. Certainly, there is a different approach to managing the finances of someone who has to deal with a chronic and potentially acute exacerbation of a chronic illness. Issues that might normally in most portfolio management, not to belabor this, you know, you can kind of pick two of three. Did you want protection from risk? Did you want return? Did you want protection from risk? Did you want liquidity, the availability to grab your funds? You're not going to get all three. You could probably get two out of three. If you don't mind locking up your money, you can get a little bit better return without exposure to risk. If you want all your money available to you and you want a return, you're going to get exposed to risk. It's kind of like, in general, two out of three is about the best that you're going to get for the most part. Well, what that two out of three is that's acceptable for a 72-year-old person in their preservation mode, trying to maintain paying their expenses, versus a 72-year-old person who is now 2 years into the development of their Parkinson's disease, markedly different. The degree of liquidity, the potential for additional expenses, locking it all up into instruments that otherwise might be particularly useful for them. I don't know why. It's become sort of my side hobby. I kind of know all the long-term care riders and all of the annuity instruments, in part because I review a lot of other people's stuff. And I'm looking down for the fine tooth of, where's the ripcord? If I need money fast, can I get it out of here without having to pay large surrender charges? It's just become sort of a... And to be clear, the financial industry has been very mindful of those three. They haven't been necessarily as sophisticated about saying, yeah, but what happens when I get old and sick? And how should these instruments morph in that regard? Planning for the use of public benefits, as I shared before, there are eligibility issues. In the end, we have a fixed number of ways to be able to pay the bills. And again, let me just put in context, broad ranges. When we're talking about assisted living, we might be talking about something that is as inexpensive as $2,000 to $2,500 per month. We might be talking about something that could be $5,000 to $6,000 a month. If we're talking about a nursing home, we could be talking about private pay bills that are upwards of $9,000 to $10,000 a month, potentially, depending upon where you are and what you need. Private pay. So it is important for all of us, irrespective of the size of the portfolio, to at least be mindful of some planning around how I'm going to use those resources. Are there people that, frankly, have enough that it is unlikely that they're ever going to need assistance from somebody else? Yes. Is it also possible, as some of your questions pointed toward, for them to be able to make themselves eligible in that way? Yes. And there's some moral considerations in that that we need to think about. But here's your general list. You can use your own money. You can use your own money or somebody else's money. Here's the somebody else's in the world. The somebody else's in the money is the insurance company that you paid for a policy for them to have a big pot of money for you if you needed it. That's insurance, right? You pay smaller amounts of dollars over a period of time in exchange for, if you need it under certain risk profile, a large pot of money that you would otherwise not be able to accumulate on your own. That's the nature of insurance, okay? And so insurance would be one. Third-party payer in the form of insurance ain't cheap, is complicated. We'll talk a little bit about it in a minute. Pieces I wanted to, on this slide, make sure that you're clear about it, the stuff that generally don't pay for custodial long-term care, and that's Medicare. Medicare is medical insurance. It's health insurance. Medicare, somebody asked this great question. A, B, C, D, Medicare. What's the alphabet soup of Medicare, okay? Medicare A generally pays for hospitals and hospital-affiliated stuff. Medicare B pays for physicians and physician kind of related stuff. Medicare D is the pharmaceutical benefit, and C is what we rarely but sometimes refer to as a different way of receiving your Medicare and what's called an advantage plan, where within the parameters of that, you can have your Medicare in a different form than traditional Medicare. Okay? None of those have any significant amount of any custodial care attached to them at all. Providing for somebody's bathing, dressing, toileting, activities of daily living. It's not in there. Medicare doesn't pay for that. They'll throw it in if you're in the process of getting better at the time. So if you're, you know, obviously, if you need that stuff done for you while you're over at the hospital or while you're rehabbing after you've been let out of the hospital, that's perfectly acceptable. That's included in it. But if that's all that's left, you're not recuperating from anything any longer. You're not rehabbing from any. We're not fixing anything. Then at that point, Medicare is out. That's not Medicare's responsibility any longer. There's only one place where it deviates from that, and that would be that there's a point in your life where under the right circumstances of terminal illness, you are able to exchange the benefits of your Medicare for a new set of benefits, and it's called hospice. In that regard, and to be honest, I shared with you before, my personal history, I found nursing to be this incredibly beautiful, historically beautiful profession. I'm not sure I can think of a better place where who a nurse is and how a nurse does his or her work that is better represented than in hospice. When your goals, frankly, at this point no longer are curative, they're no longer interaction with the medical community, in those types of medical goals, they are now about comfort and they are about dignity. And at that point, it's pretty basic nursing. You're back to Nightingale at that point. And from my perspective, I find it particularly beautiful. But it's a different way of organizing your Medicare. Beyond that, that's the single most important thing I want you to remember about this section of it. Medicare does not pay for that stuff, okay? So we're either going to find bucks on our own, buy the right to bucks from somebody else, or use up our dollars in one way or another such that we are eligible for other benefits. Now, where would those other benefits? Oh, I did want to mention, long-term care insurance is one means of being able to do that. Increasingly, more and more life insurance companies, particularly as long-term care insurance is getting more expensive, more restrictive, the underwriting is not going very well. Because if you think about it, the risk is so substantial and the costs are so great that I listened to my 2011 lecture. This was spring of 2011, last evening, just to kind of refresh on what I had talked about last time. And I realized, wow, that industry has changed dramatically since that period of time. I would have recommended to everybody, and any of you in the insurance industry would know what I'm talking about, I would generally recommend if you could possibly afford it, okay, either pay a single premium kind of policy or get something that will be paid up in 7 to 10 years. Because the risk of premium increases out there is just too great. Get rid of it. Now finding somebody that will let you do that is very, very rare. It just can't be done in most cases. Because why would they exchange that risk? They want the ability to be able to, you know, adjust the premium that's going to be required later on. You don't want them to do that. It's a tough time in the particular industry right now. But increasingly, a lot of life insurance companies are now saying, you know what, we get it. We get what's going on out here. We know we're going to have to give this money to somebody sometime upon your death. Under certain rules, we'll let you reach in to some of that death benefit and use that during your life in exchange for less death benefit on. Now, you got a lot of devil in the details. Because you remember, I'm taking money that they might be expecting to be paid way then, and they're going to give up all the time value of that money by giving it to you now. It's going to be a lot less then, potentially. So you need to think that through. But more and more life insurance policies are having those kinds of living benefits, and they're worth exploring and looking at, particularly for those in this room, young and old, who are in a position where you could still be underwritten pretty well. Remember, if you're in pretty decent shape right now, even if you're 10 years older or 15 years older than when you bought that life insurance policy, the mortality tables may have changed once or twice since that time. You might actually end up for about the same amount of money or just a little bit more, ending up with a policy that would fit your benefit a lot better that could be used for something like that. It's worth kicking around, okay? Obviously, as I'll share in a second, a lot of insurance companies that were at one time involved in long-term care and are now pulling out of that market are actually creating hybrids where you could take some other of your assets. I mean, say you had a life insurance policy that had accumulated a bunch of cash, okay? And you're going to give it to somebody. Your kids might get it, or the ministry that you want to give it to is going to get this. But truth of the matter is, it's not a big high priority in your plan any longer, but they have to get that money. Conversely, you don't have any other plan for long-term, how you're going to finance your long-term care. There are instances where, without any kind of taxable event, you can take that cash and drop it into a policy that is designed for long-term care, exchanging that less-than-needed death benefit for a very much-needed life long-term care benefit. There's some stuff going on out there, but it's a very, very fast-moving market right now. Lots of changes, and that's in part because everybody's speculation as to how much it costs to take care of older folks seems each time to be less money, more money the next time that we take a look at it in that regard. I want to make sure that before we lose all of our time, I talk about Veterans Administration and Medicaid, okay? Hang on with this next slide. Let me talk about the VA for a second. Because Medicaid, I'll talk about it a little bit more carefully. And this is important. For any of you who are vets, and we can talk about this if you want to, I can get you some additional information. You know, Richard's moral perspective on this. The Medicaid program, and hence any Medicaid, any intentional efforts that you make to make yourself eligible for the Medicaid program, have to at least be somewhat morally suspect. Now, you got to be careful about this. Because fundamentally, I'm asking my neighbors to pay for my care. Okay? And so when you talk about, particularly increasingly, we see folks that are moving large amounts of assets using irrevocable trusts, gifting to family members, things like that. Under the auspices, first off, fallaciously, of I don't want the government to have it. The government isn't asking to have it. It's to pay for some services. There's some stuff you need to buy. Well, really what you're saying is, I don't want to pay for those stuff. I want somebody else to pay for those stuff. Well, if it's through the Medicaid program, I mean, let's deal with this honestly, morally. What I'm saying is, I think passing money on to the people I want to pass it on to is more important to me than asking my neighbors to pay for my care bills. It's also, to some degree, personally problematic when you realize that the Medicaid program and the funding of the Medicaid program is right now one of the most vulnerable parts of our public finance system, period. What it's going to look like at the time that you choose to use it could be very, very different. That's always the case. Why? Because it's not an entitlement. It's a safety net. It's a public benefit for people who don't have anything else. So if you make yourself not have anything else by passing the dollars on, you're accepting some vulnerabilities, and you just need to be clear about that. Are there instances in which one could look at that and morally make an argument for it? Absolutely. Lawfully, follow the rules, you follow the rules. It's like the tax code. In that regard, I'll render to Caesar what I rendered to Caesar, but if you find out at the end of the year that I rendered twice what I needed to, I don't think you keep me around as your planner, and you probably fire the accountant along with me, right? But there is a moral question to be asked about all of that. There's also a practical question to be asked about that. Richard's perspective on VA is different from that. Veterans Administration, there are pensions available. They're not huge, they're not enormous, but they're significant for the right person. They can allow somebody to stay in an assisted living facility or a home environment for a much longer period of time, potentially indefinitely, because of that extra $1,000 to $2,000 every month that comes in from the aid in attendance program. It's quirky rules. You had to have served during a combat period. Okay, so if you were between wars, not so much. You had to at least have a certain limited window of time that you were in active duty. So if you're a reservist that entire time or National Guard that entire time, you might not make it. Okay, so the eligibilities are a little bit quirky. But the bottom line is, if you, and you didn't have to actually be in harm's way, you had to be available for duty during a period of time where you could be in harm's way. So you could have been sitting in Poughkeepsie working on a little calculator, and you still served during World War II, Korea, Vietnam, now Desert Storm. And I'm not sure where it is, where we are, but I know Desert Storm is included. Any of those conflicts, okay? And you didn't necessarily have to serve in a combat position, but if you served during that period of time, there is a pension that might be available to you if you got to the point of assets being low enough, okay? And you needed that particular income to be able to pay for your medical bills. The aid in attendance program is what it's called. The homebound benefit of the aid in attendance program is the one that serves at a smaller pension for folks at home. How do I see that different? I see it different because any of you that served, thank you. Thank you. More likely than not, particularly if you served during that World War II generation, I don't want to think about what my society would look like if we lost. So the truth of the matter is we do owe something to you. And if that's one of the benefits I can provide for you, to be clear, or your surviving spouse, your widow or widower also applies. It's a slightly lower benefit than for the actual vet himself or herself, but it's there, and it's an important thing to review for everybody. Why is it particularly important relative to Medicaid? Okay, because the limits, they're a little bit loose, somewhere between $50,000 and $80,000. If you have that as your net worth, and you have income not adequate to be able to pay for your care bills at home or assisted living facility, you are likely eligible for the aid in attendance program if you serve during that combat period. Quick rules kind of on that. But they don't have any transfer penalties. So you could have $180,000 and go give $100,000 to somebody, and now you have $80,000 or $160,000 and you get rid of the $100,000. You've got $60,000. There you go. You could be eligible for the program. No harm, no foul, unless you need to go to Medicaid in the next 5 years. And the rules of the look-back period for Medicaid is you apply in the last 5 years and you move those dollars, you just created a penalty from being able to participate in the Medicaid program. So increasingly where people are getting excited, incidentally, including assisted living and home care administrators, are getting very excited about telling people, hey, are you a vet? Are you a vet? Just serve? God bless you. Thank you for your service. And here's this pension. They also need to say, if you're planning on moving dollars out of your name in order to make that pension, you better also have some reason to believe that in the next 5 years, you're not going to need Medicaid services because it's going to get rejected. And it could be a real problem in terms of coordinating those benefits. I'm going to pass on the other discussions about long-term care insurance, except for the fact that long-term care insurance, right, if I find another pocket of money to be able to pay for my bills, I'm certainly preserving assets and income by using somebody else's money. But more importantly than that, most people that are buying long-term care insurance policies, and incidentally, most people that are buying long-term care insurance policies are not in their 70s and 80s. They're in their 50s, okay? Most of the folks that are buying those, increasingly the children of people who are dealing with elder care, incidentally, who knows better that they want to have a different mechanism for themselves, they're doing it in order to be able to preserve their choices. They're looking out ahead, and they're saying, I don't like how this piece of the health finance system is working. I want to know I got my own bucks, that I can take whatever choices. If they no longer offer me services in some other way, I'm going to have an additional dollars that I can make my choices on my own, and I'm not going to stick my kids with that, potentially. Yes?
I had one question. So if you're 65 or older, it doesn't make much sense to go buy long-term care insurance. Am I reading that right?
No. Why? I'm sorry. How? No, it's an underwritten product. So eligibility becomes the first thing. You could be 56 years old and not get it because you're just too sick to be able to do it. You could be 80. You're going to have to take a look at the cost-benefit analysis of how much they're going to be charging you per month to do that. In most cases, to get in a policy affordable for somebody in advanced age also means it doesn't have a whole lot of benefit. That's just somebody getting a sale. And so it's the relationship between age and health that really matters. Now, increasingly, long-term care insurance companies are stepping away from lots of graduation. You could be ultra-preferred, preferred, standard, substandard, substandard, substandard. No, no, no. Now it's getting more binary. We're either going to give you the insurance or we're not going to give you the insurance. And when they look at the medical records, if there's too much risk out there, and again, think now not like your life insurance. It's not risk that you'll die. It's risk that you won't die. It's risk that you've got something that is going to make you sick and not kill you. Okay? So they're looking at orthopedic issues, right? They've got nothing that indicates whether dementia is a potential. Most of the neurological stuff we don't have any predictors of anyway. So what they're looking for things is, how bad is that back that you've had a bad back with? Is bad meaning that it's affecting your golf swing? We like you, okay? If it's bad meaning you've had 3 cortisone injections in the last 6 months, we aren't going to talk to you any further, okay? So it all, it's they're looking for morbidity issues, things that would prompt you to go on in. Risk of stroke would be probably the classic example. So if your hypertension is out of control, it's in control, maybe we're good. You see a long record of really nice, normal, within normal limits kinds of, you know, but if you've got uncontrolled risk factors for something that in one moment will create massive amounts of expense for them, they're probably going to pass on you. And that's kind of the environment. Medicaid, just very, very briefly, I've described it. It's kind of the safety net program. It is a significant payer for long-term care services, particularly nursing home services, okay? But it is a safety net program. And why do I bring it to a place like this? Well, I bring it that discussion, and you've seen some of kind of how it works. You've heard words like snapshot, you know, which is what were your assets at the time of the beginning of the illness that was the, you know, led you to this particular, you know, what moment in time are you looking at my assets? Can I move them on later on down? Or at what point do I begin looking at what I'm worth when I'm asking their assistance? A look back period, a lot of folks a number of years ago, back in 2006, there was a lot of consternation because they said, oh, they're going to look back in my records for 3 years to see if I moved any of my dollars around, and that turned into 5 years. Oh, if only that was the change. The big change there was previously, if I moved my assets around 4 years before, or 3 years or less before, the penalty began immediately. Now the penalty doesn't begin until I walk in, I'm eligible for Medicaid, and at that point they're going to inform me, excuse me, you moved $60,000? We'll see you in 10 months. Take care. Figure out how you're going to deal with it between now and then. Go ask those kids back for it. And incidentally, if you can't get it back from those kids that you gave it to, the Attorney General will be more than willing on your behalf to go sue the kids to get the money. So it's, and yeah, depending upon the county, it gets pretty hardball out there, depending upon kind of how we're looking at it. Now, that's important to remember, since right now, particularly in our community, there are some of my colleagues who do Medicaid planning, attorney colleagues that do Medicaid planning, with a sensitivity to the moral issues in this, recognizing the fact that we as a people here in this room, Romans 13, would always want to do so in a lawful way, but we would also want to do so in a way that met the greater goals for this person, and in a way that we felt morally good about what we were doing. There are good elder lawyers like that who will still do Medicaid planning under certain circumstances, including transfers of wealth. Okay? There are others who will tell you, don't worry, I'll take care of it. $10,000 to $12,000, I will make this problem go away, and you won't have to pay that nasty nursing home. What? Excuse me? Is there another service that I could be? I mean, I'd love for you guys to take care of my landscapers for me. It was far too expensive last year. Is there any way I can possibly have eligibility so that you guys could pay for my landscaping for me? I mean, the reason is I wanted the landscaping, right? So I'm not going to turn around and say bad things about the landscaper that I just hired. You're buying nursing services from someone. There's a cost attached to that, okay? Let's not try to use our language to spin around the moral dilemma. In some cases, it may be a perfectly legitimate move on your part. There's estate planning reasons. There's a disabled child. There's other circumstances where I need to pass some estate down, okay? And there's a moral imperative to do that, and I have to balance those kinds of things. and I'm willing to accept some of the risks that go along with me personally to do that. That's a far cry different than saying, I don't want to pay for this, I don't have to pay for it, I can make myself eligible through these particular actions. Just because something is lawful doesn't necessarily mean that it's morally sound to do. Let's see. There are, incidentally, just so that you're clear, there are a whole number of other mechanisms for someone other than transferring dollars back and forth across generations to be able to be eligible for Medicaid benefits. I'm not going to go into the math on it in this point. But picture a situation where husband and wife together, they make no distinctions, whose name's on the account doesn't matter. You got $300,000 of net worth. They're going to look at it as you got $150,000, you got $150,000. Okay? Whoever's the unimpaired person has limits of how much that they're allowed to keep. Say it's around $120,000, okay? The rest of those dollars go over and need to be spent first for that other person. But how they're spent is not necessarily by handing the money directly to the care facility or to the home care company. How they're spent can include spending it on the housing of the person who's still in the community. Now it's time to get that new roof. Now it's time to redo that. Anything that would involve being able to keep that person in a secure, stable home environment up to $500,000 of equity value in their property, you can do. That's a substantial amount of money. I got a lot of contractors who think I'm a really cool guy. Because we're just stuff to do on the house. You've been delaying it all these years. You were frugal. If there's ever a time now to make sure that mom's going to be safe at home, that we get that accomplished now by moving those dollars over and we move toward eligibility. Funerals, right? They're going to have to get done one or another. Prepaying them ahead of time would be how we move part of dad's money to mom through the prepayment of each of their funerals. Perfectly lawful, no transfer issues. There's a number of different ways. There's also some rules around caregiving. Children can be hired under caregiver contracts, and dollars can be passed out to them in that regard. And you could fluidly kind of move dollars through. I have some families where they have chosen to take those dollars, net them out for taxes, because they're going to be taking it as income, and then park it over here on the side. When mom and dad run out of their dollars, mom and dad have another little account over here. They'll go on to Medicaid, and maybe some of the amenities that I couldn't get with the Medicaid, I can now use those private dollars for. There's a number of different ways that you can work with a caregiving situation. I mentioned one of them to you before with the lady who nearly broke my foot, where family members literally can live with the person that they care for, merging those households together, and assets as large as the house itself can be transferred over. If that's done lawfully, it's done carefully, and it's done over time. So there's lots of stuff that we can do. I think in here, in this context, the only thing I'm going to encourage you about the Medicaid program is to make sure that you are aware of the moral considerations in all of this, okay? That we as a people need to be above reproach. And so if in this matter, going back to where we started this morning, if in this matter we're riding down with the same kind of language and the same kind of base motives in our estate planning, and we're not seeing ourselves as somebody who are actually responsible, as per Timothy, to take care of our own and the others of our community, but rather we're putting ourselves in a posture that somebody's supposed to be taking care of us, we have to at least question the morality on that and thinking that through.
Richard, could you talk a minute about estate recovery in connection
with
Medicaid?
Yeah. There are every state has to comply with federal guidelines that if public dollars have gone toward your care, there will be the opportunity to at least get some of those dollars back should there ever be anything that occurs after your death. And again, this would in cases be the second spouse. If there's two spouses, the estate recovery means after they're both gone, if there's any money left over that is available to their estate. So I'm not talking about a life insurance policy, for instance, that might go out to a named beneficiary. That goes straight to that party. Okay, but if there's anything that falls back into their estate, the state has the right to say, we want some repayment. It could be variable, state by state. They all just have to show compliance with the law. So in some states, they get back about 5%. Some states, they get about 80% back. Okay, it all depends. All right, and it's highly negotiable in that regard. And it's wisely something that you would have somebody like me or an attorney working with at that point in estate recovery. But they will place liens on property. You know, they will have the state named as the beneficiary on insurance instruments and on particularly investments like annuities and the like, so that after the second death, there will be the opportunity for the state to get some of that money back. And actually, that's for protection of all of you as as taxpayers. You know, you helped these family during that time. You want to recoup some of your costs, right, for what you did for this family during that time of their need, if they're no longer in need at this point. Neither spouse is going to need that. So in general, our society has huge, and you'll see that in that law, huge protections of one spouse for another. I mean, really. I mean, we're pretty good about that. But the underlying assumption is that the state has no obligation, the people have no obligation to protect the transfer of wealth from one generation to another. Now, that may not be particularly wise. There are things economists will tell me get done at generations, types of investments intergenerationally, types of giving and ministry and charity that exist across generations that we may be killing with this health finance system that we're in. And there could be huge implications for that. But to be clear, right now the code says, mm-mm. Furthermore, please be advised, as I have you walk out of this room moments, please be advised, if you are meeting with an attorney, talking about something that involves transfers, ask about things like the tax ramifications of that. Not just can it be done, but what will be the costs of it being done. If I transfer, for instance, an IRA to someone else, I've created one-time taxable event. It potentially, depending on the size, may have driven me into the highest tax rate at that particular point. It might still be worth it, but maybe not so much, okay? Here's the last piece that I wanted to make sure that we touch upon, and actually, the vast majority of your questions I've been able to address in the midst of this discussion, but I will touch on a couple of the clinical ones. This is just my last caveat for all of you, and particularly for those of you who right now know that as time ticked away from us, you have somebody that you have to go home and take care of. I travel a good bit. Many of you do as well. It's almost what the flight attendants walk us through in the beginning. You almost don't pay attention any longer because you've heard it so many times, right? Okay? And occasionally it'll catch your eye up there when you're seeing them do the little pointing toward the entrances and telling you where the little lights are along the bottom and like. But they always get to that one point that if you're worth a new flyer, they like give a little gasp or they pay attention or they perk up or they hit you or something like that. And that's that point where they say, in the unlikely event of a sudden drop of cabin pressure, and that little thing pops out of the top. Okay? And they show you with that little wonderful motion that they have of stretching the little thing around their head, but they won't do it actually because it'll hurt their hair. They show you how the mask is supposed to work, but they always finish with the next statement, which is, in that event, please secure your own mask before assisting the person next to you. It's just reasonable here. One of the greatest vulnerabilities that I see in many caregiving situations that I walk into are the fact that the caregiver himself or herself, is looking so vulnerable right now. They fall out of the system and the whole system falls apart. The single biggest thing that we can do right now is to try to shore up a little bit of respite in order to make sure that this person can still hang in there during the midst of this. Respite is simply buying some time for whatever that is. Prayer, the women's Bible study, fellowship, silver sneakers, whatever it is that this person needs to stay, because they too, much like the one they care for, are a whole person integrated who needs to make sure that we're attending to those kinds of things. Okay? Furthermore, those of you that are earlier in this process, and particularly of the next generation, this is also the time for you to look at your own affairs and make sure that you've put them on, if not onto autopilot, passive investing, you've at least got something good in place and solid that you, for all practical purposes, could neglect it for a little while and have it survivable. If your portfolio is in such a position of risk, if your investments or your legal affairs are so scattered, then to be honest with you, you paying attention to this caregiving situation of this other generation is going to put you in a position of vulnerability now or into the future. As I shared with you before, a lot of the folks buying long-term care insurance are because they look at their parents' generation, they're seeing what's happening there, they don't like what those outcomes are, and they're looking at their own budget to see, is there any way I can afford to make sure that I have a different alternative than that? But in either case, the ability to be able to, you know, one of the adages that we have, we copped it from Ron Blue, he allowed us to use it, kind of our dear friend of our practice. He said that, you know, you reached a finish line in your retirement planning when you get to the point where you are free to give, free to go. Your life is back out on the altar before the Lord. There's no place you have to show up in order to be able to sustain yourself. You are now available for whatever is the next adventure that the Lord would have for you in the most mundane quiet or in the uttermost parts of the world. Okay? Free to give, free to go. I would add to that, free to grieve. to be in a position where your own affairs are well enough that now this situation that you're in, let's go back to where we started this morning, is where we're going to finish this morning. We can recognize God's providence in it. Not necessarily his pleasant providence in it. This may be the hardest thing I've ever gone through in my life. But some of you across this room, as I scan across, think of the hardest things you've gone through. That bankruptcy that you went through. That stillbirth you went through. Think of those experiences. With enough hindsight and the opportunity to lay those out with thanksgiving, in prayer and petition before the Lord, how you gained as a human being out of this. It was so, as sad and as challenging as it is to find yourself in a caregiving situation like this in the first place, how even more so to be so engrossed in it, so busy in it, that you don't have the opportunity to see God's hand in the midst of it and how he, in his providence, is guiding you through this and who the person is that he's going to have you be on the other end of this, in the midst of it. Free to give, free to go, free to grieve, free to pray, free to deal with. So I highly commend those of you that are in this situation. Please, please address those. What I'm going to do, I'm going to close this on that. Okay, I'm going to actually close this in prayer. I'm going to take a look again here, and some of you want to stick around, but I know I've already kept you a little bit too late. I apologize to those for whom I removed one of their bathroom breaks. As you remember, coming from my nursing background, I hope that didn't cause anyone a problem here. But we won't go into that. Father, thank you even for the chuckles at the end of it, Lord God. Here's the deal, Lord. We trust you. We trust you. You're trustworthy. We don't doubt you in this. We doubt ourselves. We are a frail and a vulnerable people. And whether that's in the things that can happen to us that bring us to this circumstance or even in our desire and our motives to love and to care for somebody else in the midst of this, we are a frail and a fallible and an often falling people. But you are the God of the universe. You can do all things. And you can carry us along through Christ who strengthens us. I pray, Lord God, right now that you would bless those represented in this room who are in a vulnerable position, those who are loving them, those who are making decisions. Please, Lord God, allow us to be the body of Christ that would shine, that we here within this congregation, we family next to family, could rebuild a wall to your honor, to the protection of those who are vulnerable inside. And that, Lord God, you would be proud of us for our efforts. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.